Appeals. So we are continuing our oral arguments for this calendar date, February 10th, 2021. I'll ask the marshal to call us into session and call the third case on the calendar.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bradfold, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Diane B. Bradfold presiding. Now calling in the matter of the civil commitment of Matthew Sean Froelich, case number A201437.
All right, and good morning, and again, welcome to the court. I'll state just a few preliminary matters before we go ahead with argument. First of all, I will just quickly check the connections. I know they've been previously checked, but just to make sure, Mr. Holton, you can hear me, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And I can hear you, very good. And then is it Mr. Basie, is that how you say it?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you, good morning.
Good morning, and I can hear you as well. So although we are appearing and handling this argument via Zoom today, you know that our procedures remain the same. And so I'll just remind you of a couple of them. First of all, before you begin your argument, make sure that you identify yourself as well as the client you represent before starting your remarks. This helps us preserve our oral recording and our record of today's proceedings. And then secondly, I'll ask you to keep your eye on the clock. It should be visible on the screen. 15 minutes for each side and then 5 minutes for rebuttal for appellant. It tends to go quickly. We very much look forward to having a conversation with you about this case. So with that, we are ready to hear from counsel for appellant when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Tanner Holton and I represent the appellant, Matthew Sean Froelich. It pleases the court, counsel, this case involves a person's fundamental right to bodily autonomy. The Minnesota legislature, by enacting the processes detailed in 253B.092 subdivision 7, and the courts through Jarvis and its progeny have strived to protect a person's right to bodily autonomy. The sequential analysis contained in Minnesota statute 253B.092 subdivision 7 is a detailed statute that balances a person's right to bodily autonomy and a person's need of treatment. Minnesota statute 253B.092 subdivision 7 makes one thing very clear. If a person has capacity to make decisions regarding their mental health treatment, they have the right to refuse intrusive medical procedures and forced medications. The court is required to defer to a person who has capacity and their wishes. Assuming a person currently lacks capacity, the next step in the sequential analysis.
Mr. Holden, can I just stop you for a moment? I just want to make sure that I understand what your argument is here. Do you contend that your client had the capacity in October of 2020 to make decisions regarding neuroleptic medications?
I do make that contention, Your Honor.
And what evidence would suggest that was the case at the time of the Jarvis hearing?
And Your Honor, I guess when the court looks at the full record, I understand that the experts testified that Mr. Froelich lacked capacity, and I understand the court's decision and the findings that he lacked capacity by a preponderance of the evidence. I'm not saying that Mr. Froelich necessarily had capacity. I'm saying that the court applied the wrong burden in that analysis. And I guess that's more of my second argument, but I believe that the court needs to apply the clear and convincing standard as opposed to the preponderance of the evidence standard, which was applied by the court and which is contained in Minnesota statutes.
And that's why I'm trying to understand if we agree with you, how would that make a difference on this record?
And Your Honor, I guess on this record, if the court determines that my client did not have capacity on that date, October of 2020, I wouldn't be surprised. However, given my representation of my client and I guess his best interest, I do believe that the court needs to apply the clear and convincing standard rather than the preponderance standard, which was noted by the court. I think that there is some evidence that my client had capacity in 2020. It wasn't explored as thoroughly as the other issue contained in 253B.092. Regardless, I believe that the district court applied the wrong standard and I feel that the court should clarify that issue that standard issue because it has been come up in several cases, whether or not the appropriate standard is the preponderance of the evidence or the clear and convincing standard.
And so if we accept that and agree with you that the district court applied the wrong standard to that sort of initial question about whether your client had capacity on October 20th of 2020, would you be asking for a remand for the district court to apply the correct standard?
That's correct, Your Honor. And however, in my opinion, the court doesn't even need to go that far. And 253B.092 states, subdivision 7B states that even if a person lacks capacity at the time of the hearing or at the time of the evaluations, if they clearly stated their wishes at a time when they had capacity, the court is still obligated to abide by those wishes. Mr. Froelich entered into evidence his mental health advance directive, which clearly states his wishes. He clearly stated he did not want to take psychotropic medications. Those medications, as testified by all the doctors and the advanced practice registered nurse, includes neuroleptic medications. They described it as some sort of umbrella term. So given that, Mr. Froelich did clearly state his wishes. The other thing that's required—
Can I ask you about that clear statement of the wishes? I mean, as I read the statute, subdivision 7C says, if the evidence of the patient's wishes is conflicting, then the court should look at what a reasonable person would do. And I'm looking at the mental health advance directive here, and I'm looking at subpart E, which is, I think, his advance directive of if he's not, doesn't have the competency or the capacity to consent to treatment, he's asked to initial one of the following options. And instead your client initials 5 out of the 6. You know, some of them that lists particular medications and others says I consent to the medications agreed to by my mental health care surrogate. Isn't there conflict within the advance directive itself that would permit the district court to go ahead and assess the factors that it did?
And Your Honor, I don't believe so. I believe that the mental health advance directive is very clear with regard to one particular aspect, and that's the aspect that's in question here. That's he does not want to take any psychotropic medications. And as I indicated, psychotropic medications is an umbrella term which would include the neuroleptic medications that the court ordered here.
Mr. Holton, looking at the statute again, and let's assume for the moment that we're not really concerned with subdivision 7A. We're looking at B and C, and you have the clearly stated in the statute in B, and then C is if there's conflict, then you can look to other evidence. In addition, under 7B, there's the requirement that the person had the capacity at the time of the directive. So my first question is, what is the standard of review that we would apply to a determination that the directive was clear or not in conflict with itself?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that once a mental health advance directive has been provided, I believe that it goes on the party objecting to that directive to show that it is that the person didn't have capacity or that the wishes weren't clearly stated. I don't believe that the record presented at the evidentiary hearing supports either of those things. I don't think that.
But that's a slightly separate question. The first step for me is what's our standard of review as we're looking at the district court order or the district court determinations here. It's clear that the district court did look at other evidence besides the directive. So you can assume, I suppose, that the district court at some point decided that subdivision 7C would apply. But my question is, what is the standard of review that we apply to a district court's decision that the directive is either clear or not? And then same question, what's the standard of review to the district court's decision that the person had capacity at the time of the directive or not? Not the burden of proof, who has the burden of proof, but what's our standard of review of those? Is it application of a statutory term of art to a set of facts? Is it just a straight clear error review of fact findings? What is our standard of review on those two kind of criteria when you're looking at a directive?
Yes, Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question. The standard review that I provided to the court was de novo, and that was based on my assumption that the court failed to properly consider 253B.092 subdivision 7B. I don't believe that the court can assume that my client lacked capacity in 2012. There's no evidence that was submitted that he lacked capacity in 2012. And I don't believe that the court can say that he didn't clearly express his wishes, because I believe that he did clearly express his wishes. So I believe that the court committed error by skipping subdivision 7B and going straight to 7C, where he asserts or went into an analysis of the reasonableness standard.
Are there any findings of fact at all regarding the two criteria, that this be clear or not in conflict, and then secondly, capacity at the time?
I don't believe there are any findings of fact. I believe there's one note in the order that just says, I have considered respondents' mental health advance directive. I believe that's the only notation in the order that references the mental health advance directive. And Your Honors, counsel for the state in this case made an argument that Mr. Froelich's prior civil commitments and his prior history should be considered, and that given that he's in the past acquiesced to neuroleptic medications, that creates a conflict. First off, those facts were not entered into the record. The counsel was inappropriate in bringing those up in its brief. And even if that is the case, that there was prior civil commitments and the prior use of the medication would result in a conflict with the mental health directive, I believe that that mental health advance directive doesn't become effective until my client lacks capacity. So even if he was acquiescing to the use of neuroleptic medications in the past, the court should disregard that. I don't know if he was or not. People stipulate,
Doesn't the record in this particular commitment proceeding include the fact that your client was taking Latuda regularly and able to, you know, live in the community, and then was concerned about his prescription expiring and so tapered off and then stopped taking the medication, which then precipitated his decompensation? Isn't that part of this record?
I believe that is part of this record. I was speaking more generally. I guess one particular statement that I have a problem with is, and I'm quoting counsel here, for the two 2017 orders, Mr. Froelich stipulated to their entry, thus showing no opposition to treatment with neuroleptic medications. That statement's not only an inappropriate reference to allegations outside the record, but I would also just note that people stipulate to things for a variety of reasons. And I don't know the facts regarding this, because I didn't explore those and they weren't brought up to me, but a threat of a prolonged stay at AMRTC, that could be a reason for someone to take neuroleptic medications, or even the threat of someone wanting to decide for themselves what medications that go into their body, saying if you don't acquiesce, we're going to force medications on you. That might be a reason for someone to stipulate to that statement. Another argument that the counsel makes goes ironically to 253B.03 subdivision 6D subpart D, which is titled the rights of the patients. Contrary to counsel's position, the statute referenced merely states that a physician or an advanced practice registered nurse who wishes to subject a person who has a valid mental health care directive to intrusive treatment must get a court order. It does not provide an alternative means to get a court order that would disregard 253B.092 subdivision 7. And based on what counsel argues in their brief, it does appear that they're suggesting that this is an exception to 253B.092 and that it provides its own way for a court to, or for a doctor or an advanced practice registered nurse to get a order forcing neuroleptic medications on someone. It's my opinion and it's my stance here that chapter 253B.03, that just merely states that if a doctor or an advanced practice nurse wants to subject someone to treatment, they need to get a court order. And how do you do that? You go to 253.092 subdivision 7. Speaking briefly, I see my time is winding down here. I believe that there's the question on the past case law on what standard to apply to a person finding a court finding that someone is incapacitated. The court has in the past referenced that clear and convincing standard. The court has also referenced that they're going to apply the preponderance of the evidence standard. I think that the court needs to address this discrepancy and provide clear guidance on what standard should be applied and what the district court should be doing.
What would be the argument for us to disregard the statutory language?
Well, Your Honor, I guess my argument would be a constitutional one. I would also note the case law that has been written by the Court of Appeals, but because this intrusion into someone's body is such a well-preserved right, and it's, I guess, so intrusive for the state to do that, I believe that clear and convincing standard is appropriate. And
isn't that why our court in Brault, for example, said when you get to the second stage, the subdivision 7 stage of the analysis, in fact, you do have to have clear and convincing evidence before you can, deal with someone's fundamental right to bodily autonomy, as you've described it. Why isn't that bringing clear and convincing evidence in as the evidentiary standard on that second question? Why isn't that sufficient to meet constitutional concerns?
And Your Honor, I do believe that's a good argument, and that's one that counsel made. I would just counter that I believe that the finding of incapacity is so important to the neuroleptic process and the Jarvis process that it also needs to have that clear and convincing evidence standard. If someone's found to lack capacity, I believe that the court needs to apply the clear and convincing standard to that as well. And I see that my time is done. If the court has no questions, I will turn it over.
It looks like we are ready to wait, Mr. Holton. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So, all right, with that, Mr. Basie, we're ready to hear from respondents when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Brandon Basie. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent in this matter. Consistent with the opinions of all three experts that provided testimony in this case, the district court correctly granted the respondent's petition for authorization to treat Mr. Froehlich with neuroleptic medication. All three experts in this case testified that Mr. Froehlich's major mental illness could only be treated with neuroleptic medication, and that the benefits to neuroleptic medication far outweighed any risks presented. Even Mr. Froehlich's mother at the hearing admitted that Mr. Froehlich would need neuroleptic medication in order to get better. Mr. Froehlich's position that the district court should have denied the petition based on the 2012 Declaration of Preferences regarding neuroleptic medication is wrong for two fundamental reasons, Your Honor. First, the Declaration of Preferences was not effectively witnessed in 2012. And second, the declaration does not demonstrate it's not an accurate reflection of Mr. Froehlich's current position on neuroleptic medication.
Can I stop you for a minute? I have a fundamental question, I guess, with respect to your argument, and that is, how can we review the district court's consideration of Mr. Froehlich's 2012 advanced directive in the absence of any findings of fact?
How can you analyze the propriety of that directive? Is that the question, Your Honor?
Well, and perhaps that gets to the standard of review question, but I mean, you're asking us to essentially look at findings that the court didn't make.
Your Honor, I think that the answer to that question, I think I have four responses. First, Minnesota law allows the district court to disregard a healthcare directive. And so I don't think the court even needs to look at what the healthcare directive, whether it was proper or improper, because the law allows the court to go by that. But second, Your Honor, although the court's order might not have been as thorough as the court may want, it did make findings with regard to the reasonableness of treatment. It did make findings that that Mr. Froehlich had not stated a clear choice regarding neuroleptic medication currently. And so while the commissioner acknowledges that there wasn't an analysis of whether the directive was properly witnessed, that wasn't part of the findings, It's well established that this court is permitted to affirm a district court on any basis that's supported by the record. And in this case, I don't think there's any dispute as to the factual findings or to, appellant didn't make any, file a reply brief or make any issue with the argument as far as the factual record regarding this. I think it's clear that the facts show that in 2012, that the witnesses in this case had no knowledge regarding treatment with neuroleptic medication. And under the law, in order for a declaration of preferences to be valid, the declaration must have two witnesses, and the witnesses must include a statement that they believe the declarant understands the nature and the significance of the declaration. And here, the declaration had none of that information. The witnesses made no statement that Mr. Froelich understood the nature and significance of the declaration. It simply stated that they believed he was of sound mind. Ms. Froelich, his mother, admitted at the hearing, she stated that those questions weren't asked of the witnesses. And she later said she didn't know, but she did say that they didn't know. I think that's the first fundamental problem is that the declaration itself isn't even valid. But even if it were valid, Your Honors, the second fundamental problem that Mr. Froelich faces is that the requirement that there must, in order for under the statute to defer to his wishes, there must be a clear statement of his preferences. And 2012 simply just is not where we stand today. 2012 was 8 years ago, coming up on 9 years ago. And in the meantime, there have been numerous instances of Mr. Froelich taking neuroleptic medication voluntarily or stipulating to them.
Is there any case law that says just the passage of time permits a court to disregard what a patient may clearly have stated?
I don't think there is, and that's not the argument, Your Honor. I think that if it was the case that someone, I think that there's no problem with a 20-year-old healthcare directive being valid under certain facts. Those facts aren't present in this case. In this case, Your Honors, after 2012, we have an individual who on two separate occasions stipulated through counsel in a prior Jarvis proceedings that he would take neuroleptic medication. You have in a third Jarvis proceeding, the findings of fact in that order showed that a family member stated that they thought they could work with his treatment team on neuroleptic medication. And most relevant, Your Honor, is immediately preceding this commitment in this specific case, Mr. Froelich was taking neuroleptic medication voluntarily. And so for Mr. Froelich to stand here today and claim his healthcare directive that states, I don't want any neuroleptic medication at all from 2012 is clearly contrary to what he actually has done as recently as just last year. And so even if the healthcare directive was properly witnessed, there's still the issue of the fact that his wishes are not clearly stated and or are conflicting. And if you're conflicting, you move on to subdivision 7C of the statute, which looks to the reasonable person standard.
Before we get there, I guess my question is, the legislature was very clear, in my opinion, on subdivision 6D, saying that the burden is preponderance. And I think that our court has made it clear that for other aspects of this decision, the burden is not preponderance, but it is clear and convincing. So my question is, you're looking in subdivision 6D, the decision that has to be proven by preponderance regarding incapacity is at the time of the hearing. And that's different from the incapacity decision that is made under subdivision 7B. So my question for you is, which do you think, what is the standard of proof? And I know that the legislature said the word, you know, burden, but they're both talking about the burden and the standard of proof. So what is the standard of proof when you're looking at past incapacity or capacity under subdivision 7?
Your Honor, under subdivision 7, I don't think subdivision 7 is making a capacity determination. Subdivision 7 is looking what a reasonable person would do or what the intentions were.
When subdivision 7B talks about the directive and it requires some determination that at the time of the directive, quote, the patient had the capacity to make a reasoned decision. So that decision of capacity at the time of the directive, is that subject to the standard of proof in subdivision 6 regarding incapacity at the time of the Jarvis hearing? Or is that, in your view, subject to clear and convincing under our Brawl opinion or Brault regarding clear and convincing for everything other than subdivision 6?
Your Honor, I think you're correct. I'm sorry, I misunderstood the question, but thank you for clarifying. I think you are correct that the statute isn't clear. It's the commissioner's position that it would be a preponderance of the evidence standard for that question. And the reason for that is this: clear and convincing, as the Supreme Court has identified, clear and convincing evidence is required for situations that require that the state or that the government, the courts have some interest in that's more than just, you know, your normal civil case. In the Addington case that opposing counsel cites, the court, U.S. Supreme Court discussed why clear and convincing is required for the initial commitment decision, because you're taking away someone's liberty, rights to be part of a free society. Determination of capacity, whether it's in subdivision 6 in this case, or determining someone's capacity to make a decision regarding their healthcare directive, doesn't implicate any liberty interest of a person. You're not taking any right away from that person. Because even if you find that the person lacked capacity to either consent today or to lack capacity to consent 8 years ago at the time of the 2012 directive, you still have the next question, which is administration with neuroleptic medication reasonable? And that this court has held in the Brault decision is clear and convincing. And that protects an individual's rights to personal autonomy and to privacy. I do acknowledge, and I think counsel stated this, that there wasn't any testimony. I don't think that there was any testimony regarding his capacity at the time of 2012. But again, assuming that that he had capacity in 2012 to enter into that healthcare directive, what is undisputed is that he has since agreed to neuroleptic medication. And so the idea that he cannot, that he opposes all administration of neuroleptic medication is simply conflicting with the record today. Your Honors, even if the healthcare directive was validly witnessed, and even if it still showed a preference today of what his desires are, the Minnesota law still allows a court to set aside a healthcare directive and issue an order authorizing a doctor to treat someone with neuroleptic medication. 253B.03 subdivision 6DD specifically states that a physician needs a court order in order to treat somebody contrary to their expressed wishes. So in order to do that, they have to go to a court. And so for a court to not be able to issue that order, it just simply doesn't make sense under the plain language of the statute.
But that seems to be a little bit different than what to me seems pretty clear in subdivision 7, right? If the patient clearly stated what the patient would choose to do when that patient had capacity, the patient's wishes must be followed. It doesn't say unless the doctor gets a court order to the contrary, right? So under subdivision 7B, it seems pretty clear that if you have an advanced directive and that was clear and that was, well, that person had capacity, what room is there in the statute when the words in the statute are the patient's wishes must be followed?
Your Honor, I would say subdivision 253B.03 and the subdivision 6 specifically applies to treatment with neuroleptic medication. It talks about a directive regarding intrusive mental health treatment, and intrusive mental health treatment by the statute is defined as neuroleptic treatment with a neuroleptic medication, or I think it also includes electroconvulsive shock therapy. Second, Your Honor, I think on its face, there might be some issues that they do seem to create a tension. And the commissioner is not denying that there seems to be a tension between 253B.03 subdivision 6D and 6DD and 092 subdivision 7B. However, it's the commissioner's belief, and I think that the law supports this, that 253B.092, when you have two irreconcilable statutes, you look to see which is more general and which is more specific. And in this case, Your Honor, 092 is a general neuroleptic medication statute that applies to not only people who are civilly committed, but also to those persons who are proposed patients, people who a petition has been filed but not yet actually committed. It also, 092 also applies to people who are chemically dependent or people who are committed with a developmental disability. Subdivision 0360D only applies to patients who are actually committed and only applies to two types of commitments. Those are persons who are mentally ill and a dangerous to others, and those who are committed as mentally ill. There's an argument, I think, that it could also apply to those committed as sexually dangerous and sexually psychopathic, but I think that that's neither here nor there as a general matter, that the 03 statute is a more specific statute because it applies to a smaller subset of people than the 092 statute does. Your Honors, as the commissioner stated, there are multiple reasons why the district court's opinion should be affirmed in this case. There are multiple avenues for the court to affirm the decision. And unless the court has any further questions, Your Honor, the commissioner would, or the respondent would respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. All right, the clock has been reset. Mr. Holton, you can proceed with rebuttal when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honors. I would like to start with a response to counsel's argument that the declaration of preferences was not validly executed. Under 253B.092 subdivision 7B, there's no requirement that this document or this clearly expressed wish be made through a declaration of preferences. Under that statute, this could be an oral argument or an oral statement, or as long as it's clear and at a time when they had capacity. It could be written on a post-it note that says, I don't want to take neuroleptic medications. There's no requirement that any patient get a declaration of preferences in order for their wishes to be followed. Additionally, I just like to address, counsel made a comment that Mr. Froelich's only chance of recovering was these neuroleptic medications and that all three doctors indicated such. I would also note that the transcript shows that the doctors acknowledge that Mr. Froelich could get better without neuroleptic medications, that they are not required for him to regain capacity or for him to reenter society. They did, however, say that it was highly unlikely that he do that, but they did not say it was the only way. With regard to the counsel's argument that 253B.03 subdivision 6D subpart D and 253B.092 subdivision 7B being irreconcilable, I would also disagree with that. As I briefly noted before, all that 253B.03 does is it allows a doctor or an advanced practice registered nurse to go get a court order if they have questions about capacity and if there is a declaration of preferences, which again is not required. The way they get that court order is to go through 253.092 subdivision 7 to go with the council and say that 03 provides a new way for someone to get a court order would be to disregard prior case law, would disregard the statutes. And it's a little alarming that counsel is arguing that even if someone has capacity, the court can overrule that person's decision. And I think that's concerning for multiple areas of law.
Mr. Holton, was this argument about 253B.03 subdivision 6DD made in the district court?
Your Honor, I believe it was by the state. I believe they referenced it in response to my motion to dismiss. And I believe they also brought it up at closing during at the evidentiary hearing. Regardless, I don't see that those statutes are irreconcilable. I believe that the courts can bring effect to both those statutes. And again, I would just note the irony that the statute that the state is relying on is under a chapter called Rights of Patients. Doesn't sound like a right of a patient, and I know that titles don't have any meaning, but with that, Your Honors, I would cede the remainder of my time.
Are there any additional questions from the panel? Okay. Thanks very much, Mr. Holton, and thanks to both lawyers in this case. It raised important issues, and we very much appreciate the careful arguments that you've made both in your written briefs and orally today. So with that, the matter is submitted to this court for its decision, and we will issue a written decision within the statutory timeframe.